In London, the Lollard Rebellion of Sir John Oldcastle was over. On September the 9th, 1415, the last ember of it was seen by the trial of John Claydon of London, and alongside him the baker Richard Gurman. There's a slight footnote to this incident. Gurman was burned alive, along with letters of pardon which the king had previously granted to him. The mayor of London had ordered his death, seemingly in defiance of the king. Which makes us ask the question, why did Mayor Fulkener act so defiantly in the face of royal authority? Did they reveal a personal hostility towards Richard Gurman? Was it a personal hostility the mayor had towards the Lollards? Was it a genuine fear that the Lollards would be about to restart their campaign a year later? Whatever the reason given, Thomas Fulkener, the mayor of London, was to find himself committed to the Tower of London for having ordered the execution of this heretic, and eventually had to pay a fine of £1,000. Henry V had not wanted that man burnt. Why? Well, the king had other matters in mind, and above all, he was clear that he felt that the Lollard affair was over with, and he had dealt with it. It explains the king's confidence in granting everybody involved really pardons. It explains the really powerful symbolic gesture he made soon after. Henry V summoned his parliament to Leicester. The parliament had originally been planned to meet in January 1414 in its usual place of Westminster, but the king changed locations. Leicester was seen as one of the centres of the Lollard theology. When it met at the end of April, nothing said symbolically more than the king was in charge and the threat from the Lollards was over than him putting his parliament right there. It was time to move on. For the king, it was to lead to him to focusing on foreign affairs and the never-ending war with France. But for London, there was the ongoing economic miasma. As I've explained over previous chapters, London was in serious financial decline and were desperate for some kind of solution. And oddly enough, the route out of London's long-running economic malaise was to come from dramatic actions to the south, because Henry V was about to change the entire geopolitical ballgame. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast that is dedicated to a narrative history of this great metropolis, told chronologically as we go along. And we've reached the most pivotal years of the reign of Henry V, and how his success in France offered London an economic lifeline. Above all, how London threw the greatest party it had ever seen. Welcome to a chapter dedicated to the most glorious episode of the Hundred Years' War, the 149th chapter of this story of London, Crispinian. In the summer of 1415, a grand fleet sailed from the Solent aiming south. The King of England, Henry V, was going to war. The departure of the expedition, as all such invasion forces were, was the culmination of a colossal exercise of preparation that had been going on for months. Men, supplies, ships, food. If you're going to invade somewhere, all these things need to be brought together, a vast logistical enterprise which costed a staggering amount of much-needed revenue. At the centre of this huge logistical operation had been the king, who had supervised both the general preparation and much of the detail. Please note, he didn't act alone. He knew more than anybody that he could only succeed if he took others into his trust and delegated responsibly. More so than anyone since his ancestor Edward III, Henry seems to have been focused on uniting the bands of nobles of England into a brotherhood. It helped him speed up this invasion. But gathering together an army of the size he wanted was one thing. Transporting it safely across the channel was another. In May, orders had gone out to the men of the south coast to resist French attacks and doubtless keep the sea lanes clear. And yet, ironically, on the same month, the admirals of England were ordered to arrest all ships from differing parts of the coast, together with their masters and crews, to make sure they should meet at Southampton for as soon as possible to help the king move his army. This need for ships was overriding and was probably unpopular. This was the height of the fishing season. The fishermen of England would have been at their busiest. None of them would have liked to have had to give up their boats to the crown to move their troops. Same applies to the mercantile fleets of London. Yet even press-ganging the fishermen and merchant fleets of England wasn't enough for the force Henry wanted to bring. In early April, delegations were being sent abroad to find ships, obviously not from France, and we know that by mid-May, ships, crews and their masters were arriving at Dover from Holland and Zealand. And why all this was happening was the never-ending war with France was heating up significantly. Part of this was because within France, the nation was now split into two separate camps, one known as the Burgundians and one known as the Armagnacs, and I will explain far more about them as we go along. We talked about the beginning of the fight, but yeah, basically this weakened the French position and left England with an opening to gain some concessions. Now, before Henry had decided to invade in 1415, he did try diplomacy and had sent various delegations over in 1413 and 1414 to try and negotiate a peaceful end to the war. English demands were both territorial and financial. Basically, they wanted to have overlordship of Normandy, Touraine, Maine, Anjou, and old Aquitaine. And then they also wanted some cash, which was the payment of the outstanding ransom of King John, who'd been captured some years before. And then they also wanted to talk about maybe a bit of a royal marriage, like the king marries the French king's daughter. You know, that way he gets a really large dowry. This diplomacy was, you know, diplomacy. They were ready to have negotiations, especially about the marriage and the financial affairs, as well as the territory, really. But they found that the French were not unified enough to be able to agree to anything, and the only thing they could agree to was that they were not conceding anything to the English. All chronicles tell us that, having heard the various ambassadors' reports, Henry decided the only way he might achieve his purpose was through war and invasion. He gave orders for arms to be gathered from every single castle in the country, and especially made a big thing about going after cannon, large gun stones and gunpowder. Now, as you know from our story, the Tower of London was one of the principal places where these weapons were stored. The long and meticulous preparations Henry then put into preparing for the war actually tell us quite a bit about the king. They reflect his growing impatience with the French, but also his need to be organized early. Time wasn't on his side. By early 1415, he realized if he didn't attack that summer, it could be a year before he went again. So he seems to have made up his mind by March and April and was planning to sail before, the end of July. As it was at the end of July, a plot seemingly to kill the king was carried out by Richard, Earl of Cambridge, brother of Duke of York, Henry, Lord Scrope of Masham, once the Treasurer of England, and Sir Thomas Grey of Heaton. Why they were trying to kill the king, I don't know. What the whole purpose behind it, it's confused historians to this day. And honestly, it's not about London. I'm moving on. But it was not until a week after that, and after the executions of the three men involved, that finally Henry was able to put to sea. And any observer would have seen a fleet of about 1,500 or so vessels, led by the massive royal flagship, the Trinity Royal, sail down the Solent to the open sea, and then sail off in the direction of France. The target for Henry's armada was Harfleur, the greatest and strategically most important port of Normandy, and the key to the unlocking the entire duchy. Situated on the north bank of the River Seine, the river upon which Rouen, the Norman capital, and higher up it, Paris, the French capital, lay, its position on the mouth of the wide Seine estuary made it a crucial target. However, it was very well defended, with very strong walls, and any invader hoping to use the river to invade Normandy simply could not bypass it or ignore it. It had to be captured, but it was a particularly difficult place to capture. I mean, one of its defences citizens could use was to flood the low ground which surrounded it. Henry's fleet actually landed a couple of miles west of Harfleur on the 13th of August. The land forces came up against ditches, dikes and bulwarks, making it tough ground before they could reach its walls. But although Harfleur was well guarded, it was still taken by surprise. And within 2 days of landing, Henry had his army in position around the town's walls, with ships blockading access to the river and the sea. The siege that followed lasted for 5 weeks, and it demonstrated the king's unwavering determination to achieve his goal despite facing quite formidable opposition and well-constructed defences. Contemporary chronicles emphasised the meticulous care he took in equipping his army for siege, highlighting not only the cannon and gunpowder he brought, but also scaling ladders, crossbows, and mining tools for undermining walls. One account of the siege describes the devastating impact of the bombards, or the heavy guns, and the lighter pieces of artillery on the town. These weapons not only breached the wall and destroyed buildings, but also served as a psychological weapon, causing huge distress amongst the largely civilian population who'd refused to surrender. The fall of Harfleur was basically inevitable, but within those walls, under the leadership of Raoul de Gaconde, they did their best to avert it. However, disease eventually erupted, many inhabitants soon succumbed, and the disease was actually foul enough that it actually spread into the English army. The Bishop of Norwich and Thomas Earl of Arundel, both friends of the king, died, and King's brother Clarence was actually sent home early because of the disease that was being found in Harfleur. But then finally, on September 22nd, 1415, a procession of the leading figures emerged from within the walls of the town and made their way to surrender. Henry sat under a dire stressed in majesty, surrounded by members of his nobility. The formal ceremony of handing over the keys was carried out with grand gestures. However, the point was, the ceremony that was done was not like that of a foreign king coming to take tribute of the newly conquered. This was a reception of rebels by their rightful lord, them recognising who was rightfully in charge. And then the following day, King Henry entered the town and went to the Church of St. Martin to give thanks for the deliverance of the place. All such ceremonies done, a symbolic re-establishment of authority and order was shown by the appointment of the king's uncle, Thomas Beaufort, Earl of Dorset, as captain of Harfleur, with a garrison of 2,000 men under him. Now, it must be noted that Henry did expel a couple of thousand or so of the inhabitants of Harfleur, and they were mostly women and children. But he dealt with them fairly humanely. I mean, he gave them an escort as they retreated off in the direction of Rouen. But his attitude towards the Normans was clear. In resisting him, they had rebelled, he felt, and while he was willing to take under his protection and restore the property of those who agreed to recognise the legality of his rule, those who would not must expect to suffer confiscation of their properties and expulsion from their homes. By doing such things and giving these justifications, the king hoped that these would be reported elsewhere and would weaken resistance for him in the future. But the fall of Harfleur ultimately was important for two reasons. First, it was now a second point of access for the English into France after Calais, and it could act as a base of stores and equipment for armies which might be active further inland. This made it an ideal military base. But secondly, all this stuff he did in Harfleur was the first example of Henry's new policy of colonisation in Normandy, a development which changed the character of the war being fought in France, and which marked a new phase of the war. Henry was making plans not just to take cities, but to hold them. However, as interesting as this is, it's a long way from London. So the purpose of the story of London is to tell the story of London. So let's get back to London. We'll just take a long roundabout route there. Let's start in Harfleur. By the time Harfleur had fallen and had all been sorted out, Henry V was presented with the difficult question of what to do next. It was now the last week in September. Valuable campaigning time had been lost sorting out this new port. What would he do now? The French clearly thought he would make for Rouen, the Norman capital, some 50 miles up the Seine, and like Harfleur, on the river's right bank. Their forces and command centre were in and around the city. They thought he would do what Edward III had tried to do, take Rouen and then march to Paris. Some wondered if he'd actually followed the example set by his brother, the Duke of Clarence, only 3 years earlier, and fight his way south to Aquitaine, or maybe start aiming at the south and await a huge payoff from the French before leaving. The problem was, Henry wasn't able to do that. While he had taken Harfleur, he was not equipped with the force designed to invade the rest of France. He was carrying an awful lot of cannon, which he'd used to bombard Harfleur into submission. He could not really march with them. I mean, armies march slow, and moving with a large artillery train, that just slows you down even more. Indeed, the more we look at it, it does seem that Henry had not intended to march into Rouen or even Paris. He brought an oversized force just to take Harfleur. So, mission accomplished, right? Here's where he had a symbolic issue. The capture of Harfleur had given the English a door into France, and at the same time, prevented the French from using it as a place to launch attacks upon English shipping on the southern coast of England. That's awesome. And it's clear that the elaborate preparations to have a siege show that Henry's determination to capture Harfleur was his principal target. But that was it, really. His force was not properly built for going south. And yet, if he returned home the way he had just come, that could be seen like a retreat. Added to that, the grand fleet he'd just gathered had probably already dissipated. He paid for it to carry the people over, but he probably couldn't have kept those ships, all 1,500 of them, in place for the 5 weeks of the siege. In fact, the truth of the matter was he probably could not return his full army by the route he had arrived by. He'd allowed those soldiers whom had sickened by disease return home by ship. But then he decided that the only way he could get back home was to call in at the other English bastion of France. Henry V realized he had to march to Calais. He was 120 miles from the port. The journey should take about 8 days. It was a risk. Any king marching into France could find the French ready to intercept them. And yet Edward III had been in a not similar position and in much the same region of France in 1346. And his son, Edward the Black Prince, had been returning to Bordeaux from a successful expedition in central France in 1356 when the French King John II had caught him up with his army. On both those occasions, when an English king had been intercepted, the battles of Crecy and later Poitiers took place, and these were massive victories for the English. So these historical precedents would have been known to Henry V, and they may have encouraged him. You know, I'll just go to march. What's the worst that can happen is they catch up with me. He did understand the risks, however. So this march began at the end of the first week of October. Henry may have been at the head of about 6,000 fighting men, together with an unknown, and we have to say unknown, number of others in supporting roles. The march did begin with an air of confidence. It had been thought it should take 8 days, and as such, opposition was clearly not expected. For the first few days, although the English were shadowed by a force of Frenchmen, all seemed to go well. One or two towns even offered to provide the army with food and drink, on the condition they didn't attack them or loot them or burn their lands down. It was only on October the 12th that, through the report of some captured Frenchmen, it was learned that a crucial ford they had to cross was held by the French, who destroyed the causeway and erected stakes, and a party of men who'd been sent by Calais to secure it had been too small. Suddenly, the easy road to Calais was blocked. This was a psychological blow, quite considerable, and it was made worse when it was learned that a French army was now patrolling on the right bank of the Somme, waiting for the English to cross. The estimated 8 days had now passed. Calais was still a long way away, and it was clear that a major detour would have to be made so that the Somme might be crossed in safety. As such, the English were forced to march for several days up the river's left bank, further and further to the southeast. It was not until the 19th of October that, being hounded by a large French army, they managed to find a place that they could cross in, although it wasn't easy, but they did somehow manage to ford that river. And yet, while the French had failed to stop Henry from crossing the Somme, they knew they could trap him and move their forces accordingly. By now, having marched for 2 weeks, the English army was exhausted, both physically and morally. A number of men who had not recovered sufficiently from the illnesses contracted at the siege were now in a state of physical collapse. The others were worried and hungry. On October 20th, the day after crossing the Somme, French heralds approached to announce that the Duke of Orléans and Bourbon and the Constable Albret had decided that the English army should be challenged in the field. Henry replied that they would march on, and they could find him wherever he happened to be. Such news can only have lowered his men's morale even further. For 4 days after the receipt of the French challenge, Henry and his army, the men-at-arms, now wearing at least part of their armour in case of a sudden attack, moved northwestward towards Calais, perhaps aware, or probably unaware, that all the French forces had in the region had gathered together and were now a little ahead of them. On the 24th of October, having just crossed the small river, the English army caught their first sight of the French army, quote, as large as a swarm of locusts, unquote. For both the king and his forces, this was the moment of truth. They realised they would not reach Calais without confronting the French in a fight. The odds looked forbidding, and the priests in the English army were kept busy hearing confessions and granting absolution. For a while, the two armies manoeuvred, but by the end of the afternoon, it was too late to begin a battle. That would be fought the next day. Regardless of how Shakespeare portrays the Battle of Agincourt, we know that the night before, the king issued strict orders for complete silence from his armies as they settled in the orchards, fields and barns of the neighbouring village of Messancel. In fact, so quiet were the English that the French were not sure whether they had broken camp and slipped away. Henry wanted his men to get what sleep they could. I mean, after all, they'd just marched 250 miles in 17 days and had not really even enjoyed a single day of rest the entire time. However, they didn't get much rest that night. A heavy downfall began and it rained for most of the evening. By the way, the French camp, which was not far away, could be heard making merry, sure of their numbers and of their eventual victory. Very early on the next day, which is Friday the 25th of October, the king, fully armed, except for his headgear, heard three masses, because one mass isn't good enough, then donned a splendid helmet, what's been fixed a rich golden crown, so be recognisable from a distance, mounted a small grey horse, and gave orders for the baggage to be guarded. And then he ordered the army to position itself in the field. This was an area of open ground, recently ploughed and sown. It's about 1,000 yards long and 800 to 900 yards wide. Bound on the left by a wood, in which lay the village of Agincourt, and on the right, a further wood surrounding the village of Trecourt. Now, Henry was really anxious to make sure he wasn't attacked from the rear, so he placed his force in such a way that, as far as possible, it stretched across the whole width of the open ground between the woods. Inevitably, with only at most 6,000 men, and that's 1,000 men-at-arms and 5,000 archers dismounted, the line of men-at-arms, in contrast with the French, was quite thin. This line, this unbroken line across the battlefield, had the king himself, surrounded by the banners of the Trinity, the Virgin, St. George, St. Edmunds, and finally his own, right in the middle of the field. Big target, with Edward, Duke of York, in the van on his right, and in the rear, or the king's left, Thomas, Lord Comyn, was in charge of that force there. Where it was possible, there were groups or wedges of archers between the three sections. It's clear that the large majority of them were being placed on the wings, looking slightly obliquely towards the centre of the French army, which opposed them. As much as we can reconstruct what the English looked like, we have difficulty describing the French. They had brought an awful lot of men to the force, probably a force of about 20,000 fighting men or more. What the French had was a very large number of men-at-arms, dressed in heavy armour of steel which went down below their knees, and their legs and their arms were well protected, as well as their heads and their shoulders. This was a massive infantry force, drawn up in three great battles, or battalions, I suppose. It was almost exclusively dismounted. Of the three battles, one stood behind one another, with only the third, which did include cavalry, but there were mounted soldiers on each wing, which job was to fall on the archers. Right now, the battle looked very simple. The English were strung across a line in a small force, and the French, they had men to spare. And it could seem that the most simple task was just be to march up and hit the king. After all, the king had placed himself right in the centre of the line, surrounded by banners and wearing a big golden crown on his shiny metal head. Henry was acting as bait. And thus we come to the feast of St. Crispin, or Crispiana. On the morning of the battle, Henry addressed his men. The words which he uttered were the words of a soldier who appreciated the strains, both physical and psychological, that they were experiencing, and knew how to lift them out of the trough of despondency which they may have fallen. But he wasn't just an inspiring speaker. He was also able and ready to take advantage of anything which may help him. One such factor had been the awful rain that had fallen the night before. When the armies came to face it about 9 o'clock the following day, they did so across ground that was very muddy and very slippy, which provided poor footing conditions for both men-at-arms in heavy armour, and even worse for the cavalry. The rain, which had caused the English soldiery such misery in the hours of darkness, actually could turn out to be to their advantage. For some 3 hours, between 9 and midday, the opposing armies faced each other, hoping that the ground might, you know, dry a bit, but the enemy might be prevailed to make the first move across the mud. The French may have thought it likely, in the circumstances, that the English would move first. Well, the English hoped that the French cavalry and men-at-arms would engage them in their muddy field. The other problem the English had was, right now, the French were too far away. Their range of their archers, their deadly, brilliant archers, was about 200 yards. That would be the deciding factor in what was to come. Given the nature of the two armies, the condition of the ground became more and more important. The circumstances led to Henry having to make a fateful decision, probably deciding that the weight was having a terrible effect upon his men. Henry turned and supposedly said, quote, "Now is good time, for all England prayeth for us, and therefore be of good cheer, and let us go on our journey. In the name of Almighty God and St. George, avant, and St. George, this day thine help," unquote. Slowly, the English army advanced about 700 yards towards the French, and they stopped about 200 yards short of the enemy, now within range of the English arrows. There the archers drove into the ground the stakes which had been ordered to cut some days before, in a way to make it dangerous for horses and difficult for men-at-arms to attack them. It was from this second position that the English were to fight this battle. The king's aim was to make the French move towards him and bring them within range of his archers, who would then make the enemy feel the full impact of their arrows. At a range of some 200 yards, the English began to rain arrows, and at this point they could do a rate of 10 per man per minute, bringing them down upon the French men-at-arms. This immediately brought about a cavalry charge upon the archers. They may have stood their ground until the last instant before seeking a measure of safety behind the stakes that had driven into the earth like hedgehogs. Some horses impaled themselves on the stake, their riders becoming easy victims. Others, seeing the danger, tried to turn back against the forward-moving cavalry movement and brought chaos to their own ranks. Others still forced their way between the archers and the wings and the wood, managing to reach the English line and push it back, but the line still held. As the cavalry had been goaded into attacking, so had the then men-at-arms, and the bulk of the French army now sought to make an attack on the main line of the English, about 200-300 yards away. As they advanced, there came from the wings some of those horses, terrified what they just experienced, and in many cases no longer controlled by their riders. The ranks of the French advance were then broken up by fleeing horses, and the French slowly marched towards the English line. Thus, when the melee, the meeting of the French and English men-at-arms, took place, it very much went the way of the English in spite of the superior French numbers. The French were crushing one another, and we eventually had a pile of bodies, which is vividly described by the chroniclers of the time. And aided by the archers, who, having used up all their arrows, joined in a form of counterattack with knives, daggers and other weapons, including the stakes, the English men-at-arms soon made it clear that the battle could only have one outcome. As more and more French, realising this, turned to flee, they ran into their fellows still advancing from behind, and so to the extent this massacre broadened. Within an hour of its starting, it must have been evident that, barring an extraordinary reversal of fortune, the English had won. There was some confusion that followed. The king, thinking that the third battle of the French army was coming up, he ordered the execution of many of the prisoners, a moment that still haunts his historical reputation to this day. But that final wave made no impression upon the English, and Henry, who now held the field, called to him the heralds who, in their role of observers, had been watching the conflict from the wings. From the French herald, he obtained that victory was his, and on being told the name of the nearest village was Agincourt, he decided the battle should be named after it. The French had been decimated, their noble lords at best captured, at worst killed. In the evening, the king retired to a nearby village where he spent the previous night, and now he entertained some of his more illustrious prisoners, notably the Duke of Orleans, to dinner. No doubt the much body stripping must have been taking place while it was still light, and Henry felt obliged to remind his men they were not yet completely out of danger and that no man was to take more than he needed to fit himself out. On the king's orders, the remainder of the equipment taken from the French bodies was placed into a barn, which was set on fire, depriving the enemy of their future use. Early the next day, after preparations had been set in motion for the burial of most of the dead, and steps had been taken to bring home the remains of the Duke of York, the king set out for Calais, which he reached without further incident on the 29th of October. Calais did not greet Henry V warmly. The English army had had very little to eat for several days and were incredibly hungry. And nor were the French, after their defeat, the prisoners in a good state either. And Calais did not have the supplies to cope with this. It needed King Henry's full organisational skills to see that the shorter that they stayed in Calais, the better, and arranged for his army and prisoners to be shipped over to England, some landing at Dover, others at Sandwich, whence each soldier was supposedly to make their own way home. The king, however, remained in Calais for some time before leaving France for England and a very rough crossing, which meant he finally arrived on November the 15th. After a day's rest, the king made his way to Canterbury, where he was met by the archbishop there and gave thanks at the cathedral. And then passing through Rochester, he travelled towards London and took up residence in the royal manor of Eltham, southeast of the place, and there to await the formal royal reception that was to come. Henry was coming to London. For all our telling of this story of Henry V and Agincourt, the real focus is, of course, the city of London. London, who liked this king. London, on the whole, was very supportive of their rightful, strong, young monarch. And this popularity was more than just emotional or patriotic. It was also financial. It had been the Corporation of London that Henry had appealed for money early in 1415, when he was still seeking financial backing for his plans to go on an expedition to France. An appeal that led to the loan of 10,000 marks of silver and a number of smaller private loans towards the war. For London, this war had been a letter that arrived, written on the 22nd of September from the king, announcing he'd taken Harfleur, and then silence. No news had arrived since that date. The king had dissipated into the miasma of non-information. Finally, on Tuesday the 29th, the news of the victory won at Agincourt reached London. The bells of London rang out in joyful celebration, and the residents of the city marched in a grand procession to Westminster as an expression of communal joy, relief, and thanksgiving. The king had won a great victory, a mighty victory, an unprecedented victory. Well, an unprecedented one since the battles of Crécy and Poitiers. And almost at once after this celebration, the city began to prepare for the return of their king. The mayor of London that year was a man called Nicholas Wotton. He was a draper, long-standing wool merchant, and a member of London's shrinking political class. A former alderman, sheriff of London, and twice an MP, he was serving what would be his first of two terms as mayor. He was the mayor who'd begun preparations for the largest street party London had ever seen to this date. To Mayor Wotton, Henry V was simply, quote, thou conqueror, unquote. And as Henry returned from the subdued Calais and devout Canterbury celebrations, it was London who were preparing to allow him properly celebrate his great victory. On November 23rd, a Saturday, a great reception took place. Leaving Eltham, Henry came to Blackheath, where he was met by the mayor, the 24 aldermen, and a huge number of the livery companies of the city, all bedecked in their formal regalia of the guilds. And they would have marched in good spirits, in song and cheering, along the roads that today pass through Lewisham, Bermondsey, and up to Borough. The formal procession of the mayor and livery company saw the king riding along with a number of the most important prisoners taken at Agincourt, until eventually they reached Southwark. With its proximity to Lambeth, it should be no surprise that while the mayor and the city had been the mainstay of the procession until now, it was here at London Bridge that Henry was to meet the mainstay of the clergy of the city, come to bless him and heap praise in great numbers. Some had joined the procession as early as Deptford, supposedly dressed, quote, in magnificent copes, and preceded with witch crosses and cleansers, smoking with frankincense, unquote. So you can imagine this cloud of aromatic smoke, golden crosses and crucifixes flying, and then a procession of king and prisoners and mayor and aldermen marching their way to London Bridge. And instantly they would have seen that London Bridge had been transformed. Two giant wooden figures, one a man, the other a woman, had been carved in place above the tower of its entrance. Figures said to be extending a welcome to their triumphant lord, and all around them staffs bearing their royal arms. As the procession made its way onto London Bridge, clouds of incense and hymns began being sung. Thomas of Usk describes, quote, "In the midst of the bridge, in front of the drawbridge, were two outworks, in which one on the right hand was a lion bearing a lance, and in the other an antelope having a shield with the arms of the king hung around his neck. And beyond the bridge was a figure of St. George armed becomingly, and these were placed to guard the bridge," unquote. All around were teeming crowds cheering and celebrating the king. Passing the riot of noise, the king made his way along London Bridge a bit more and encountered then three wooden towers that had been constructed, two on either side and one just above the middle, and all three were covered in linen cloth painted to resemble stonework and covered in banners and decorations. In the house built next to this, choirs of boys dressed as angels sang Benedictus qui venit in nomine Domini, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord, as the king went past. His procession took him over the bridge and up towards Cornhill. There a second choir, dressed as prophets of the Old Testament, were present, and it said they released a flock of little white birds, quote, "of which some descended on the king's breast, some settled on his shoulders, and some circled around in twisted flight," unquote. In Cornhill could be seen the arms of St. George, St. Edward, St. Edmund, and of England, together with those of the royal dynasty. And from Cornhill, the king and his procession turned left into Cheapside, where they came to the Tower of the Water Conduit at the entrance of Cheapside, which they found was covered by a green cover bearing the city's arms. Under this were old men dressed as the apostles, who sang the psalms and gave the king round leaves of silver, along with wafers of bread and wine, quote, "that they might receive him with bread and wine, just as Melchizedek did Abraham when he returned from victory from the slaughter," unquote. Alongside locals dressed as the 12 apostles, others were dressed as English kings, and even more dressed as saints. And it's here on Cheapside that the celebrations really kicked in. The crowds began to get thicker. The king got as far as the middle of Cheapside, and there saw, quote, "reaching from one side to the other, as far as the Church of St. Peter, was a three-storied building mounted by a remarkable series of ladders, to which towers and bulwarks and coats of arms of the kingdom and its princes were attached, and the whole thing being constructed from planks, a remarkable example of both the skills of the carpenters and painters. It was covered with a large linen sheet, decorated in colours, so that it looked like a wall made of marble and ivory," unquote. This account goes on to say, quote, "it was completely filled with models of angels, singers and organs. Six citizens, magnificently dressed, came out of its iron gates carrying two basins made of gold and filled with gold, which they offered to the king. As he approached the lower conduit, chanting virgins came dancing to meet him, accompanied by choirs and drums and golden viols, just as in King David's time after the slaying of Goliath," unquote. At the cross of Cheapside, over which a wooden structure resembling a castle had been built, was the line, "glorious things have been recounted about thee, city of God," painted upon it. High above the gate were the arms of St. George, with those of the king on one side and those of the Holy Roman Emperor Sigismund on the other. Further along, on the way to St. Paul's Cathedral, was another scene with a canopy, regarded as a mark of honour, upheld by angelic figures, under which a figure of majesty in the form of the sun emitting dazzling rays could be seen. These amazing displays were head-turning and staggering, and they added to the occasion. And don't forget, the main thing was the spectators were here to see the king and his prisoners. They were living signs of the victory. The king himself, even though he was here in triumph, he turned many heads. What struck the contemporary minds was the contrast between the outward sign of victory and the king's sober dress and demeanour. Henry Rodonius wore only a single gown of purple. Instead of being surrounded by an escort of knights, he chose to be accompanied by a small group of men from his household, riding at a gentle pace, and seemingly more concerned with giving thanks to God than seeking glory and praise. In this way, he proceeded to St. Paul's, where he was met by a number of prelates, and at the cathedral, King Henry, quote, "dismounted and went devoutly forward to make offerings at the Holy Cross, the tomb of St. Erkenwald, and the high altar, before moving on there to dine at Westminster," unquote. Though the crowds were so thick at this point, he had difficulty getting through them. He was being mobbed. He finally made his way through and reached Westminster Abbey, where he was met by the abbot and the monks in a very considerable crowd. And then he left an offering on the shrines to St. Edward the Confessor, founder of the abbey, and much favoured patron saint. From the abbey he went to the Palace of Westminster to finally rest. The celebrations in London continued. Here now we see the earliest true shade of a London we contemporaries know only too well. A London of nationalist pride and victory. These days we tend to find it evoked only in Wembley Stadium. Here it was roar upon the streets of London itself in the aftermath of Agincourt. The next morning the celebrations continued when the king was attended by the mayor and another large group of citizens who gave him £1,000 and two gold basins. Then on the king's orders, a solemn funeral service for the dead of both sides was celebrated at St. Paul's by the bishops who were in London. The Battle of Agincourt and the wild scenes of celebration seen on London streets speak of something timeless about London. The ornate decoration and passion of the crowd is something we see to this day. There are shades of it in the Notting Hill Carnival, although today's carnival is properly uniquely Caribbean. But when you look at the celebrations of Agincourt, here is VE Day. Here is winning the World Cup in 1966. Here is religious passion and a sense of identity written large. This is London being the centre of a national Thanksgiving, a ritual we see every New Year's Eve as the bells of the Elizabeth Tower strike midnight and the sounds of Big Ben are joined by the explosions of fireworks. This is the first time London truly fulfilled this role, a role it holds to this day. Of course, there was more to these events than just a party, and it must be said there was more to come. All Henry had done was win a single large battle, and yet behind it, he had devastated the French in a way that was to give him a massive advantage in winning the aftermath of this battle. More, he had opened up a second port. Harfleur had now joined Calais. To the political class of London, led by Mayor Wootton, a man who had received tax breaks for his financial support of the king, the new conquest promised opportunity. In the wild celebrations for the victory over the French lay also a smaller but more profound celebration. London was ideally placed to take advantage of the new opportunities now opening up for London merchants. And while it would be some years before they could be exploited, and while the economic malaise which was impacting London was not ended or even dented with this one victory at this one battle, a path was seen, a way forward. A way for London to begin moving towards changing its economic situation. And London merchants and its guild members and its very workers were not going to allow it to slip through their fingers. The victory of St. Crispin's Day, the Feast of Crispianan, marked the first fluttering of a new breeze in the sails of the economic ship after years of being becalmed in the doldrums. The future, just briefly, seemed bright. And I will continue this next chapter as we plough ahead with the reign of Henry V. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Bye.